You know, wild food is all around us. Edible plants, nuts, and berries. You just have to kind of open your eyes and start looking for them, and maybe even in your own backyard. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We have Wisconsin's favorite forager, I would call him, Sam Thayer, with us now to give us some tips on wild food you can find in the fall. Sam's been teaching about wild edibles for more than two decades. He has three books on foraging, including his latest. It's a great one. It's called Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. And he joins us from Northern Wisconsin. Sam, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry, and I am happy to be with you again.
And as you listen to Sam talk, you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Do you like to forage, or what do you want to know as you look for nuts, for example, this fall? Is there something you always forage for this time of year? Maybe how do you store and cook your wild food? Lots to talk about, so give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sam, we're getting into the fall here quite a bit. What types of things are you foraging for right now?
Oh, man, Larry, I'm working long hours trying to give myself spare time so I can work long hours foraging. This is my favorite month of the year to forage. It's time to pick nuts, and I've got all, you know, there's a lot of fruit still. There's high bush cranberries out there. There's wild grapes. There's nanny berries. There's wild apples and crab apples. You know, there's still parsnip and wild carrots and all sorts of root vegetables, burdock roots, evening primrose. So there's not enough light in the day to collect all the things I want to collect right now.
Where do you find those wild edibles?
You know, they're everywhere. And one of the common questions people ask is, where do you forage? And you know what? Wherever you are, there's foraging to do. And I'll give you an example of how to get access to a place. I know some people down the road who I gave some perennial native plants to and helped them plant them and gave them some advice on putting them in. And I endeared myself to these landowners, and now they say, come back and pick hickory nuts if you want. So I'm going there to pick hickory nuts tomorrow.
So there you go. What about, we were just talking about the Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee, but what about an urban area like Milwaukee? Are there opportunities to find wild foods in the middle of the city?
Oh, yes, there is. I mean, I grew up in Wausau and Madison most of my childhood in the city, and there is lots of places to forage. There is not the same type of terrain, but what's great about urban foraging is if you learn to urban forage in a town of 2,000 people, it's the same as urban foraging in Milwaukee or Minneapolis or Boston. There is a lot of ornamental plantings in cities that produce nuts and fruits that nobody seems to want, and usually people are happy to have you get rid of them. And there's also, during the summer, there's a whole set of common urban weeds that are great vegetables. So there really is a lot to collect in urban areas.
So you don't have to go deep into the woods?
No. In fact, the edge of the woods or fence row, those are great places. Deep in the woods can be great foraging too, but your opportunities vary according to your landscape, but there's always something there.
You can join in too, by the way, with your calls or questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Cater is up with us from Herbster, so let's go there. Cater, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Anybody there? Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Cater.
Oh, okay, I can barely hear you.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm... Hey, Sam.
Hey, Cater.
I'm out, and I see a lot of nanny berry bushes. Mm-hmm. I'm out grouse hunting every day this fall. I see a lot of nanny berry bushes the last few years of all ages, you know, up from sprouts up to 10 feet high, and none of them I have seen starting in September have any berries on them. I just wondered what you had seen of the nanny berry crop this year.
What I noticed in northern Wisconsin and in your neck of the woods was a pretty heavy crop of nanny berry on the ones that were in the full sun, but they got picked off pretty early. Now, I did see in the last week of September, I was up in Ashland to teach a workshop, and we found a couple loaded bushes. And everybody on the plant walk was able to stuff their faces if they wanted to. And so normally nanny berries ripen about the 20th of September or so. And if there's not a good crop of other berries like hawthorn, the migrating robins and catbirds and the grouse and the bears will just clean the nanny berries off. And I think that's what happened this year, because the ones by me had a pretty good crop on my property, and they just got cleaned off before I could get anything. So that's part of the excitement, but also the frustration of foraging, is you never know what is going to produce a good crop that particular year.
There you go, Cater. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Somebody called the show last week, Sam, and said, I found a morel mushroom in my yard this past week. So that was just a week ago. So sometimes you get surprises, too.
Yeah, you get odd things in the fall. Sometimes I wonder, when it's in somebody's yard in the fall like this, if it was a stinkhorn and it still had its net, its webbing around it, and that makes it look a little like a morel, because I've seen people get confused there. Yeah, sometimes you get just crazy things. You know, I've seen a few serviceberry trees blooming in the last week.
What the heck is going on there, huh? Oh, man. I didn't know that Wisconsin has 15 edible species of nuts.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing, our diversity. And it depends on how you define nut. We might have even more than that. But we have 7 species of acorn, all of which are edible. And they're all kind of processed in different ways. But acorns were a staple food for Native Americans in different parts of the country, and still are an important food in Korea and parts of the Mediterranean. We have 2 species of hazelnut. In fact, hazelnuts are probably our most common upland shrub in the state. Probably no other state has as many hazelnuts as Wisconsin, except perhaps Minnesota. We are really blessed there. We've got black walnuts and butternuts. Butternuts are statewide, except for a very little bit of northern Wisconsin where they're not found. We have 2 hickories, shagbark hickory and the yellow bud or oil nut hickory, the one that goes by many, many names that we use for making our hickory oil. We have beech, which are confined to the eastern part of the state, but when they have a good crop, they are absolutely delicious. And then we also have lotus, which is a wetland plant of limited distribution, but it sometimes it's called duck acorns or water chinkapin. They're like little chestnuts, and they are delicious. And then we have hackberry, which is like a little tiny nut, like a hazelnut with a thin shell, and then it's like almost like a date around it.
Mm.
And so that's just incredibly diverse list. That's actually 16 species there.
Oh, and you mentioned acorn, and I was going through your book, I was noticing this raspberry gel thickened with acorn starch. It looked delicious. It's an all-wild dish.
It is, and it's something that you can feed your kids and not worry that you're giving them, too much sugar. It's a lot like Jell-O in its texture, but it's a little more substance to it. So if you don't want to make your own acorn or you want to get hooked on it, you can go to an Asian grocery store and buy Korean acorn starch. It's made from hand-collected wild acorns in Korea, and you mix that with you take the raspberry juice or raspberry pulp and get it hot, not necessarily boiling, but about 180 degrees, and then you whip in the acorn starch, and it's real flexible on the ratios, and then let it cool and gel, and it's like raspberry acorn Jell-O. You can mix in a little sweetener if you want, but you don't have to.
Well, it looks really good to me. I can tell you that for free. I'm looking forward to maybe trying that out. Although I'm glad to know that I can get some of that acorn starch from a store, because I'm not sure that I'd be able. I'm not as let's see, skilled as you are, let's put it that way, and how you process things. And I do want to talk with you about your hickory nut oil, because it's absolutely delicious. And we will do that. Our guest today is Sam Thayer, author of 3 books. The latest, we'll talk some more about that as well, is called Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants that Can Change Your Life. And he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We will take a look now at the news, weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back with Sam. So you stay with us. We'll be back soon. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Sam Thayer, the go-to source for keeping alive the ancient art of foraging. And we're talking with him today about wild edibles, zeroing in maybe a little on nuts. But we can talk about all kinds of foraging. He grew up in the Wausau area, in part, where he learned to gather wild food in places like vacant lots, backyards, parks, the edge of town. He operates Foragers Harvest, and you can join in with your questions about collecting wild food and storing it at 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite food you forage for this time of the year? How do you preserve it? Maybe you want to know about foraging in your area where you live. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, you know, before I go any further, Sam, maybe talk about your latest book. It's called Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. Tell us about the book. It's really a pretty book.
You know, from the very beginning, I planned this to be a set of 3 books because I want to cover each plant with a thoroughness and detail that allows somebody to feel comfortable actually going out there and using it for food, to give them all the instructions they need and all the identification information they need. So this book has some of my absolute favorite plants in the world in here, like hickory nuts. And really, I have an assortment of plants that are in all sorts of landscapes and all sorts of produce types. So I have seasonings like black mustard, and I've got, you know, the various bramble berries, raspberries, blackberries, black raspberries, and some lesser known brambles, and I've got some plants like caraway, for example, that are really, we all think of caraway like we know it as a seed, a seasoning, but a lot of people don't realize that there's caraway bread for the roots and caraway bread for the leaves and the stalks. And you can eat all of those things on wild caraway. You know, mulberries, pawpaws, and persimmons, pokeweed, some of the really iconic wild edibles in North America that our ancestors ate. I mean, as long as there's been people on this continent, those have been important foods. So there's, you know, there's 36 chapters on 36 really awesome food plants. And I encourage people to approach foraging from that perspective, as learning not foraging as a whole skill, but one plant at a time. Because you mentioned that you didn't have the skill or maybe the time to make acorn starch, but it's like learning to hunt or fish or knit or anything else. You know, you learn one step at a time, and once you know something, then you can incorporate it into your life for the rest of your life.
Those are good points, and the book is certainly a wonderful photography as well, so you really get to, you know what these plants look like, and some great great shots along with good writing, as you always, you're a good writer, so it that helps obviously as well. Gail in Reedsburg had a question or comment. Gail, hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
Well, just commenting on, it's more of a comment than a question, and following on from what he just said about it being something that you start as a child and do your whole life. I have really fond memories of foraging with my mother and grandfather, and one of our favorites was always hickory nuts. And just recently, having remembered that and always doing hickory nuts and learning to crack hickory nuts, I learned how to make hickory syrup.
Mmm.
Which I was actually quite surprised that my grandfather, that was not in his repertoire, because he made sorghum molasses and lots of stuff. But I learned hickory syrup, and it's just one of my favorite things to put on waffles with hickory nuts now. And I put it in lots of cooking as well. So.
Oh, Samory, do you ever make hickory syrup?
You know, I actually haven't. Now, Gail, I wanted to ask you, when you say hickory syrup, do you mean that you are using hickory bark as a flavoring in a syrup, or that you're actually boiling the sap down into a syrup?
No, it's not sap. It is from the bark. So it's the shagbark hickory tree. You take the pieces off that have freshly fallen on the ground, or you strip them from the tree that are the loose ones. You don't damage the tree. Scrape the lichens off with a wire brush. Mm-hmm. And I toast them for a little bit in the oven. As soon as you start to smell the toasty aroma, then you put them in water and you just simmer them for about 30 minutes gently, and you get a tea, essentially. And then you cook that down to just increase the flavor like you would on any kind of a sap. And then you convert it to a simple sugar recipe. So you just add sugar, that 1:1 to 1 or 1:2 ratio for a simple sugar. But it's just really good.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
You know, hickories are just amazing. There's so many uses for hickories. And, you know, someday I feel like I should write a book just on hickories. They are probably the most well-known and commonly eaten wild food on this continent, other than maybe maple syrup. But, you know, the Native Americans use hickory primarily in two ways that we don't generally use hickory today. And one of them is making hickory milk, and the beauty of that is it's labor efficient. So hickory nuts are difficult to crack. The only one that's easy to crack is the pecan, which a lot of people don't realize is a hickory nut, and that's why it's our major commercial hickory nut. But the other ones that are harder to crack, you can put them in a bucket or a mortar and just pound them to smithereens and boil them, and the shells sink, and this milky liquid rises up, and you stir it, you let it settle for a few seconds, and then you scoop off a ladleful of this milky liquid, and it is rich and delicious. And for the native people on this continent, at least in the eastern part of the country, it was the equivalent of what dairy was in the European diet, and it is delicious. And then the other main use of hickory nuts was to make oil. So European settlers traded the native people for hickory oil extensively for the first 250 to 300 years that white people were on this continent. That for me has been one of the most exciting things that I've kind of rediscovered or rekindled in my life is starting to make hickory oil again, because I haven't found any record of anybody making it in this country for about 200 years now. So,
well,
I got to try some.
I have tried your hickory nut oil, and I have shared it with Dave Potratz and Kate Archer Kent and Sarah Hopeful, and they're all saying, what a wonderful taste and flavor. And it's so, Dave called it smooth and crisp.
Yeah, you know, so the oil I sent you, one reason it was good is because it was fresh. You know, I keep the oil refrigerated as soon as I make it, and most oils are far better when they're fresh. But a lot of people, you know, have used hickory syrup as a flavoring, and so when I talk about hickory oil, they think that I'm talking about an oil that's like used as a flavoring. But actually, hickory oil is the mildest oil I think that I've ever tasted, except maybe grapeseed oil, which is almost flavorless. Hickory has a flavor.
Yeah.
It's a mild flavor that goes with almost anything. I mean, we pop our popcorn in it. We use it in baking. We fry our vegetables in it. I mean, we make our salad dressing with it. And it's the only vegetable oil that I like mushrooms sautéed in. It's almost like butter.
Oh, I would imagine. You know, and Kate Archer Kent had a good comment. She said it's light on your tongue.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it's 89% unsaturated. So it's a thin oil. It's a liquid oil at room temperature. In that sense, its composition is somewhat similar to olive oil, and almost identical to pecan oil.
And if you took, we were talking about it. I can just imagine some breads, maybe some homemade bread, or even some French bread, and then just dipping into that hickory oil, hickory nut oil. Oh, I can just taste it.
We love it that way. When we make our first batch, we like to get a loaf of bread from a really good artisanal bakery, like that one right in the middle of Ashland there. Get some nice, high-quality baguettes, and just we pour half a cup in a bowl, and we all crowd around it and dip our bread in the hickory oil, fresh pressed. And man, it's like dessert, but it's not dessert.
There you go. It is really. Do you sell this, Sam?
Yeah. Yes. I'm limited in how much I can collect, but I collect as much as I can. And I have, so I probably sold about 900 bottles last year.
Wow.
So I tend to sell out, but yeah, if people go on our website, they can find it. And I'm trying to get other people excited in making this. I've got one person in North Carolina making it now and one person in New York State. I think it took me taking the leap and buying an oil press and showing people, hey, this really works. And I'm not keeping any secrets about how I'm doing it or what I'm doing, because I feel like we have a great, sustainable, native tree crop like maple syrup that really produces a lot of food per acre, and it's labor efficient to use, and it's a fantastic food. And I would like to see this become something that is done all throughout the range of hickories.
Well, it is delicious. What's your website, by the way?
It's foragersharvest.com.
Foragersharvest.com. I'm telling you, it is delicious, this hickory nut oil, for sure. Well, let's go to another caller, Jed in Lake Couturier. It's your turn. Hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I just want to give thanks and praise to you both and to the woods. I was reminded by a friend the other day that every day is Thanksgiving, so I wanted to wish you a happy Thanksgiving and give you both thanks, and of course thanks to the woods. I'm a vegetable farmer turned wild mushroom forager, so just to hear it on air, peace and love to all the foragers and to the forest. I remember Yule Gibbons, I remember Gary Linkoff, and I thank you, Sam. And really, there's nothing secret, just to let it be known.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, Sam.
I second that. Thank you, and thanks to the woods, and thank you, Larry. And I'm honored to be compared to Yul Gibbons and Gary Linkoff.
Yeah, you're in good company there, Sam, for sure. Wanda in Waupaca has something. Let's go there. Wanda, hi.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to say that I laughed because in my family, we were always foragers, and my husband's the hunter, and I'm the forager. I'm the one that collects, wild asparagus, watercress. I do button mushrooms, wild button mushrooms, to oyster mushrooms, to now chick of the woods. I discovered those. When I'm in Ashland, I go out in the woods and I dig up wild leeks. Have you ever tried those?
Oh yes, yeah. In my sugar bush, I have quite a few, and I'm managing them, and I've actually long-term monitoring how they grow and how they respond to harvest. Leeks are easy to over-harvest, but they're easy to harvest responsibly.
Actually, a quick question then. I know where I dig them. I have them marked, but I was going to try to transplant them closer to our hunting shack. Is there a way that I can do that? I kept the roots on the bottom, smaller ones, and I planted them out back. They don't seem to, where I'm digging them, it's not real wet, but will they do, it's in the Shawangon forest, just like,
So
they're able to transplant them.
If you have appropriate soil, they transplant extremely well. I have transplanted many thousands of bulbs, and they transplant remarkably well. I've transplanted them in the spring when they're first coming up. I've transplanted them in the summer after the leaves have died back. I have not transplanted them in the fall. And so I can't comment on how well that works, but they're a little bit different than many plants. The root is active while the top is dormant, so the root shrinks pretty drastically in the late summer and in the fall. You might want to actually try to transplant them a little earlier in the summer, but if you put them under hardwoods with reasonably rich soil, they should thrive.
There you go. Thank you, Wanda, for calling. And let's go to Ann in Green Bay. Hi, Ann.
Hello. Well, you've piqued my interest, and I'm just wondering if you do any, like, you know, seminars or day workshops or anything like that, and I'm going to hang up and listen.
All right.
Yeah, so I do a number of programs around the Midwest, and there's certainly some other people that do all around the country. Last year, I did probably about 15 programs. I have two left this year, but they're both in New York State. But if you look on my website, forgesharvest.com, around the first of the year, I'll post next year's schedule of workshops.
And what kinds of things, basically? I think she wondered about the hickory nut oil. It might be tough to have a seminar on how to make hickory nut oil for just the average person because you need a press.
Yeah, I mean, you really do need a press. And, you know, if I drum up more interest, I will probably set aside a day to do a tour of my shop here and explain the whole process to people. But my shop is right here on Highway 8 in Bruce. And I when I'm in here pressing oil, if someone wants to email me and make sure I'm here, I'm glad to show people what I'm doing. I mean, probably 8 or 10 people came through last year, and I showed them the whole process. So, like I said, I'm not keeping any secrets because I think we have an important, sustainable industry to develop.
You know, Steve sent us a message. He wants to know if you can recommend a field guide for the wild plants in the area, maybe native or otherwise, edible or not. He's been learning about the vegetation on the southern border of Antioch, Illinois. He's been using PlantSnap. It's a plant identification app. But he'd like more help. Do you have a field guide?
Yeah, sure. You know, there's one. There's Wildflowers of Wisconsin and Neighboring States or something like that. The authors, Merrill Black and Emmett Jadeowitz, they're out of Wisconsin. Emmett is at the university in Stevens Point. That's a real good book for this region. The photos are kind of small because they have jammed a lot of species in there. I often recommend to people start with Newcomb's Wildflower Guide. I like the way that this emailer has started, though. If you're going to learn edible plants, you need to learn plants. And so you always want to get some just plant books, not just the edible plant books, because they'll help you identify kind of the whole picture of what's out there. You know, there are a lot of good books, but there isn't one single book that I would say that's the great book for our region. For identifying woody plants, trees, shrubs, and vines, the best book in the country that I've ever seen for any region is The Trees and Shrubs of Minnesota by Welby Smith, and it covers almost all the same ones as are found in Wisconsin, and that book is like an encyclopedia, a key, and a field guide in one. Great book. We're lucky to have it here. So there's some places to start.
Adam in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Adam. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sam. Thanks a lot. Yeah, just a quick question about burdock root and dandelion root and the relative bitterness or sweetness depending on if you harvest it in the spring or if you harvest it in the fall.
Well, I don't notice the flavor of burdock root changing very much throughout the year in terms of the bitterness. It seems to be sweeter in the fall or early spring. But, you know, burdock typically lives for 2 to 4 years before it blooms. And then the plant dies. And so you can collect those roots in the middle of summer. There will be rosettes. They're not bitter. They're just not quite as sweet. And for dandelion, the root is always somewhat bitter. The key is, you know, dandelions can live for decades. If you want to use the root as a vegetable, which is actually a pretty good vegetable, if you parboil it, most of that, the bitterness goes away, and it's a very pleasant flavor that remains. But you want to get young dandelions, 1 or 2 years old. After that, they tend to get woody spots. They tend to get rotten spots in them and they get a funky shape and become hard to clean. So I haven't noticed a big difference in flavor from year of different times of year with dandelion because they always seem somewhat bitter to me.
Huh. There you go. Thank you so much, Adam. On your on the cover of your book, you've got something that looks pretty delicious to me.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a purple poppy mallow. And that I threw it on there because it looks like such a nice vegetable, and it's a really exciting plant to me. It just barely comes into Wisconsin. In fact, the DNR considers it not native to the state. But it so a friend and I, we kind of manage the one population in the state because we think it is native. It's very common in parts of the Great Plains. It's real common in Kansas and Nebraska. And, you know, this is a vegetable that looks like a parsnip, doesn't taste like a parsnip. It's more in texture like a cross between a parsnip and a potato, but it's real mild. It's related to the original marshmallow root that marshmallows used to be made from. And to me, it's so exciting because it's such a great vegetable, and it's so easy to grow in poor, sandy soil. And it reminds me, just like the hickory oil, of all the wonderful foods that are native to this continent that a dominant Euro-American culture has not yet developed a relationship with. And in so many parts of the country, this is such an easy plant to grow, and it's native. It's food for native wildlife. Pocket gophers thrive on it. Deer eat the tops, and it's gorgeous. People plant this. You can get it at nurseries quite easily just because it's so darn gorgeous. The flowers are incredible. Another name that it goes by is prairie wine cups, because it has this deep burgundy flower. So look into that plant, purple poppy mallow or prairie wine cups. If you've got poor sandy soil in a sunny spot, you can grow it.
Well, I tell you what, it's always fun to talk with you, Sam. Your book is it says Incredible Wild Edibles. It's an incredible book. Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. And tell us again, where do people go for your website?
My website is foragersharvest.com, and if you want to buy my books, you can get them on Amazon, my website, or whatever bookstore you prefer. They're pretty easy to find.
Yeah, they should be. And Sam, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Always fun to talk with you, and I hope we get a chance to talk again soon. I love your hickory nut oil. Thanks,
all right,
Sam.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Sam Thayer is the author. Samuel Thayer, Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow at this time, what we eat and drink has a big impact on the health of our teeth. So we'll look at sugary sweets and all that and how they affect your teeth with a dentist. So I'm looking forward to that as well. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.